Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last year, millions of America's school children sat in their classrooms as terrorists attacked their country, their national home. In the stunned weeks and months that followed, America's teachers had to do some quick thinking about the unthinkable, to answer or at least address the unanswerable, to add new lessons to their plans, lessons about history and hatred, about global citizenship and national patriotism. Today, America's teachers still struggle with how to help students understand what can seem beyond understanding. This hour, On Point, what do we tell the kids? How should we teach September 11th to students who lived through it? We begin in New York City. Karen Manasseh is a social worker at the 12th Street Academy, a charter school on Manhattan's Lower East Side. She works with troubled 7th and 8th graders. I spoke with her earlier and asked her how, a year on, she sees September 11th affecting the kids she works with.
In so many different ways. I mean, when I think back on last school year, initially, certainly that day, there was an enormous amount of fear, a lot of confusion and shock. And then as the school year progressed, I would say more anger came out as well. And the fear continues and hasn't really gone away. It just kind of changes forms. But it's still very there and present.
You're a social worker, presumably, and these are middle school kids. Presumably you deal with the kids who are having the most difficulty with it, or are you dealing with whole classrooms full of children who are affected still by 9/11 at some upsetting level?
The kids are referred to me for a host of different reasons, and I did have some that were referred last year specifically because of struggles they were having around 9/11. However, it's really hard to separate because these are kids that already have a lot going on with them. They're struggling with so many different things, domestic violence in their home or abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, alcohol and drugs in their house, a parent who's left. So there was already so much going on, and so this is another thing to add to all of that. The whole thing about it is when you have a new trauma, it exacerbates the previous trauma. So that's what makes it so complicated and tough to diagnose what exactly is what.
But can you see the distinct imprint of the September 11th attacks on top of everything else that the children are coping with?
Definitely, definitely. Kids who might have had some anxiety, for example, are more anxious. And last year, you know, part of the process of working in middle school is the kids are going to apply to high schools. And a lot of the kids were applying to schools that were right near them, down the street or a couple blocks over, and they verbalized to me that they were literally afraid to go to schools that were farther away or where they couldn't get home at a moment's notice.
They want to be close to family and home.
Exactly. In addition to that, I would say fears of flying and kids who had nightmares about flying, kids who didn't take trips because they didn't want to get on a plane, or they did but they were really, really nervous beforehand. Some kids who were absent more because they were afraid to leave their families and go to school.
Were they ready to admit that this was related to 9/11, or is this you as a social worker interpreting their anxiety?
A number of them were able to admit it because they were having conversations about 9/11 with their families, and the whole thing is that their whole world, I mean, our whole world changed overnight. And so for these kids, there's no safety in the same way, and while a lot of them didn't have safety before, you still rely on your parent or guardian being okay. And for them to watch their parent or guardian's anxiety, I mean, teachers, as much as they're trying to hold it together, certainly immediately afterwards, their own fears and anxieties, and the kids feel all of that.
Karen, do you have a sense of how that event, especially among these children who were so close to it there in Manhattan, how that event may leave a long-term imprint on their capacity for trust, love, openness to feeling security?
I think that it absolutely impacts their long-term trust and security because things that were once there aren't there anymore. Kids who lived within vision of the World Trade Center and you go home every day and you saw that and then it's not there, they're used to having people they love leave, and that is really, really hard. But then a building, and you think a building will always be there, and then that's not there anymore. Mm-hmm. And what kind of universe is that? And you add that to all the anthrax stuff that was happening at the time. So it's not like there was this horrible thing that happened and then the world is all okay again, because it's not. And every day in the news, there's more stuff happening.
So even now, a year later, you don't feel them growing calluses or sort of toughening up to the idea of a harder, more menacing world? Do they still feel vulnerable to that?
I think they do. I think it depends on the kid. I think for some of the adolescent boys, they might express it in a different way, in a more angry way, because you want to have control over a situation. And I hate to generalize on gender, but maybe for some of the girls it might be easier to express it. That's not a hard and fast statement, but certainly as an adolescent boy, they're so socialized to not admit any kind of fears.
And Karen, when you can tease out this 9/11 thread of fear or anger at the psychological level, which is, I guess, part of where you work,
right?
What do you say to these 12, 13, 14-year-old New Yorkers?
Well, I listen a lot. And then to not tell them that the world is okay and everything's perfectly safe, because it's not. And I think another important thing for them is for life to go on in some way so that they can attend to the business of being adolescents.
Karen Manasseh, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Karen Manasseh is a social worker at the 12th Street Academy in Manhattan's Lower East Side. She spoke to us earlier from Manhattan. Grown-ups are having enough difficulty struggling to make meaning of last September's attacks for themselves. But for many adults, there's a second task: how on earth to explain it to the kids. How to explain the muddy waters of fear and threat and world politics so that a child can begin to understand, but still be a child. It's uncharted territory for most of us. As a sign of the enormity of the task, Mr. Rogers recently stepped out of retirement to pitch in. In a series of public service announcements, he offers parents some advice about how to talk to their children.
There may be a lot of images on television around September 11th that could confuse and even frighten children. Ordinarily, young children can't tell what's live and what's being rebroadcast. So one good idea is to try to limit what they see and hear on television. Of course, what they need to hear most from us adults is that we can talk with them about anything and that we'll do all we can to keep them safe, no matter what goes on in the world.
Over the past year, America's teachers have fielded the tough questions from students. It's their job. They must teach their students about September 11th. They must answer the questions. But what should they say? How and what should our youth be taught about September 11th? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tonight we're joined by three teachers from around the country. Brian Poon is in the studio with me. He's a history teacher at Brookline High School in Brookline, Massachusetts. Good to have you, Brian Poon.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. Catherine Lurch joins us from Indianapolis, Indiana. She teaches history to ninth graders at the Park Tudor School. Thanks for joining us, Catherine Lurch.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. I also teach German.
Great. History and German.
History and German.
And from East Orange, New Jersey, we're joined by Dawn Renee Chase. She teaches fourth and fifth graders at the Cochrane Academy Magnet School in East Orange. Good evening and welcome, Dawn Renee Chase.
Good evening, and thank you.
Also with us tonight from WNYC's studios in New York City is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
It's great to have this roundtable. All of us have struggled in this past year to take on board what 9/11 meant. The three of you have had to teach it. Brian Poon, Take us right out of the initial experience. You were in the classroom, presumably, with students last year on September 11th when this happened. In the minutes, the days, the weeks that followed that, what were the initial challenges of helping your students come to grips with this, even as you were coming to grips with it yourself?
I think that the challenge for teaching my kids had a lot to do with getting them to understand the basics of what happened and why. I think that the seniors that I teach aren't that unlike you and I in that they were confused, they were hurt, they wanted to do something. And so they were challenged by all those emotions at once. Why? How could the great tragedy have happened to us now, you know?
And Dawn Renee Chase, you have fourth and fifth graders, much younger than the seniors Brian Poon teaches. What was the first reaction? Were they able to take on board what had happened? Did you have to spell it out for them? Did they come to school knowing?
Well, what happened was, actually, one of my colleagues had come into the classroom to tell me that a plane had gone into one of the towers. And we have a television, so we turned it on at that time. And as we were watching it, we actually saw the second plane go into the tower. And, I mean, I had to really just get myself together and not burst out crying in front of the children. So what I did at that time was turned off the television. And though I work in a public school, I said that we had to have prayer right then and there. And that was what we did. And then I turned the television back on, and one of my students began to cry, and I asked him, well, what's wrong? And he said, my father works over there. And I said, okay, we're going to stop. And I turned the television off and did not turn it back on in front of the children. And we are just thankful that his father was okay. But also, because so many parents came in to get their children out of school, that left a lot of children in school saying, well, Miss Chase, what's going on? Why are parents coming to get their children?
Where are my parents?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so it was very difficult to, what we tried to do was to continue on with our schedule for that day. And then once the next day came, we were able to kind of at least have a little bit of understanding of what was going on to be able to talk to the children about it.
But what a moment to actually witness it on television with your 8 and 9-year-olds who in East Orange are not far from Lower Manhattan. Catherine Lurch, your ninth graders in Indianapolis are at a what might have felt like a safe distance from New York on that day. What were the initial challenges for you there?
Well, it was a challenging day. Primarily, it was a little bit different from other situations. We were going through our standardized national and state tests that day, so that few students had come to school because they were just a little bit late and had heard the news on their car radios and quickly came into the homerooms and reported on what was happening. And, of course, we wanted to keep a little semblance of calm and focus, if at all possible, before they went downstairs into the testing halls. And we found that it was to keep them focused was our hard thing. And as teachers, of course, we wanted to understand what was going on, knowing how to deal with our students and to help them out in this on very certain time for them. And we had to wait about 3 hours until the tests ended. I had the desire to turn on the computer at my monitoring station to find out, but I figured then the students would be distracted. I would be, I know, emotionally distracted.
So you actually kept them in a kind of a testing cocoon until they were finished.
They were tested until almost noon that day.
Wow.
So they missed out on a lot of that. And, of course, as soon as they broke out of the halls, they wanted to find out.
It was a lot to learn.
It was a lot to learn. This was for our freshman and sophomore students.
But that cocoon couldn't last. Brian Poon, in the months after 9/11, what are the questions that were welling up out of your seniors in high school?
My seniors, I think they wanted to make sense out of it. And the way they asked questions, it was difficult. I think that a lot of teachers struggled with how do you go on with your curriculum in light of a national tragedy. And so we would stop and we would ask questions at times, but it's difficult when you're teaching, you know, advanced placement European history to take time out to do 9/11 processing time. But we did. I mean, I think you have to make time. And the school, I think, really supported that. We had a teach-in at the school, and so we brought in a wide range of people to speak about their perspectives. And we gave the kids, hopefully, space where they could ask questions to make sense of what was going on.
We'll come back and talk about some of those questions. But, Jack Beatty, there's the notion of processing time for 9/11. It's something to be processed, but it's also something to learn about. What a challenge to teach 9/11.
Yes, and we see how difficult our opinion leaders and our politicians have explaining all the background in 9/11. Imagine springing that on a child. But, you know, as Dawn was telling that extraordinary story about watching the disaster with the kids on television, I just can't imagine what that was like. I was put in mind of a story a friend of mine told me about how she got the word of Pearl Harbor. She was in California. She was maybe 4 or 5. She was swimming in the shallows of a beach, and her mother was back on the beach. And suddenly she saw her mother running. And she said, I've never saw my mother run before. And her mother ran and ran and picked her up and hugged her. And that's when she learned that we were at war.
Well, a different kind of trauma a year ago. What is most important to teach our children about 9/11? How should 9/11 be explained to American students? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about teaching 9/11. Earlier, we sat down with several kids from the Boston area and asked them for their take on the events of this past year.
It should be taught in school because it drastically changed the way people look at America and the way America looks at itself and the world. And I think it should be taught in terms of what led up to it and what its effects were.
Before September 11th, I really wasn't the type of person who watched the news, but now I find out that like at least 3 times a week, I find myself watching the news just to be more aware of what's going around, what's going on in Iraq and around the world.
I think I know why it happened, because I think USA is starting to get in too many people's wars. It's like if Afghanistan's fighting Pakistan, just for example, USA will probably go on another person's side and fight for them. I think if anybody is getting into wars around the world, just let it be.
The other day I was in the bus, and there was a bunch of kids who I guess were in elementary school, and this woman came in, and she looked like she was of Afghanistan descent, and then they started laughing and yelling terrorists and stuff like that. I realized that lots of kids and people in general just like blaming a whole group of people for something that another group had done. And so I'm more aware of like a lot of racism that's going on now.
Boston area students on September 11th and its aftermath. We're talking tonight with three teachers from around the country about teaching 9/11. What is most important to teach our children about that day and what's come since? Is 9/11 a platform for teaching morality, right and wrong, good and evil? Or is it a platform for teaching about America's complex role in the world, in the Middle East? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Dawn Renee Chase in East Orange, New Jersey, Brian Poon, who teaches in Brookline, Massachusetts, high school seniors, and Catherine Lurch, a ninth grade history and German teacher at the Park Tudor School in Indianapolis, Indiana. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. Brian Poon, you know what a hot potato, almost loaded question this issue of how to teach 9/11 has become in the months since that day. There are many schools of thought in the United States. Everybody knows the death that happened on that day. Everyone feels the tragedy of that. But what lies behind it? What to make of it is a question. It's been debated. We see in the Wall Street Journal today on the op-ed page, William Bennett saying that we're living in a teachable moment, where he wants to have teachers teaching about moral clarity, the clarity that calls evil by its true name, to grasp that terms like evil, wrong, and bad were rightly put back into our lexicon on that day. But he says some would squander this moment or repudiate it altogether as though we have nothing to learn, nothing to teach. How have you juggled these issues of teaching the facts, of teaching, talking about morality, of talking about the complexity of global interactions?
I think the word you use, which is really appropriate, is complex. I mean, when William Bennett says that it's time for us to teach morality, I think that he misses the point. I don't think that he really wants me to teach my morality at his children. To teach well, I think that you have to give students the space to speak. One of the people earlier was talking about listening, and I think that's so key. You have to hear what students want. Now, as a teacher, I think at this teachable moment, balancing between memorializing, honoring the feelings, and the fact that some of my students lost loved ones with this idea of getting the larger political context is extremely difficult. And so, as a teacher, my job, I think, rather than proselytizing to young people, is really getting them to think critically. I mean, in the end, I think it's my job.
But when they ask you, Brian Poon, why did this happen, what do you say?
When they ask me, well, they don't ask me why did it happen. I don't think it comes out that way.
What do they ask?
I think that when my students ask me about 9/11, I think it's more they already have some information, and then they want to process it. if they ask me why, my students wouldn't ask me why did it happen, because I think that they already have a sense. They want to debate with each other their different perspectives of why it happened.
And what's the debate you're hearing when they do that?
I think the debate is sort of the debate which is happening in our society as a whole. There's a patriotic debate in that at this point in time, we should give up some of our civil liberties for the good of the country. And then the other side is quite critical of the United States and what we're doing worldwide. And so the debate centers, I think, around, well, what does it mean to be patriotic? Does that mean that you allow the government certain leeway? Or does it mean that you're even more critical at this time of the government so that they will do the right thing?
And as a teacher, you stand above that debate and let them hash it out because do you stand above it?
I think what does it mean when you say stand above it?
Well, do you take a side in that debate?
I try not to. I think that as a teacher, if I take a side, then I'm going to take both sides. In that as a teacher, I don't think it's my role necessarily to teach morality to my kids.
Catherine Lurch, I'm reading here from a University of Maryland professor. This is Thomas Weibel, who's giving advice on how to teach about 9/11. And he says, middle and high school students are interested in moral issues and judgment, but it's not our job to influence these decisions or inculcate our political viewpoints. The bottom line is they need to hear valid multiple viewpoints so they can mold their own thinking and opinions. Is that the approach that you take with your students, or is this a teachable moment, as William Bennett says, to talk about good and evil, right and wrong?
I would say it's a combination of both. I was interviewing my students today just to get a sense from them. They've moved beyond the step of asking questions, why, as Brian was saying. They are moving to the point where they want to know what motivates the disparate groups of individuals to take such actions.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get them to that point? I'm not going to stand there. I'm not going to be in lecture mode. That's not what I want to do. I want them to take some ownership in this and step into and figure out ways that they can gain greater perspective on these events, whether it is reading international editions of newspapers, whether it's listening to CNN.de in Germany, or if it's going to reading the Economist magazine.
Does it feel urgent to them, Catherine Lurch? Do you feel that your middle school students, your ninth graders, are really hungry to have answers about what's going on here?
Well, you may consider them partially middle school students in some ways. They seem that way. Ninth graders, they're in our high school.
Oh, all right. I'm sorry.
But they're interested. They're curious. They want to know. But they feel as though they understand all the events and things that took place a year ago. But now they're to this next level. How can I come to a better understanding of the questions of Islam, of the Muslim culture, and, of course, the Western civilization? It is an absolutely ideal way of dealing with this. We just finished with a unit on Greece. And, of course, with the origins of direct democracy in Athens, this is a wonderful leaping off place. But then they don't know yet enough of the material that they can handle to deal with the other cultures in the Middle East, with Muhammad, with the Jewish diaspora, the Crusades. Of course, that will be part of the thing that we'll touch into. Next year, they will go on into non-Western history. Well, they'll have another year's opportunity to look at Islam, Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism.
There's a world to learn about, to learn where we stand with this thing.
There's a whole world.
Don Renee Chase, I'm sorry, Catherine Lurch, but I want to bring Don Renee Chase in. Don, you're in a community that knows tough stuff even without 9/11 in East Orange, New Jersey. These are not children who have lived sheltered lives. How did they, coming from the almost the shadow of the World Trade Center in a tough community, how did they initially think about 9/11? How does it live in their minds and in their questions in your classroom today?
Well, it's funny because as I was listening to the other teachers and the question that you asked them, are their students asking why did this happen? That's actually what my students were asking,
mm-hmm.
You know, being the youngsters that they are. Why did this happen? Why do people think that that things are happening so badly that they should destroy other lives? And the thing that I say, I had to take a role out. I am a teacher, but before a teacher, I am a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to let them know that, yes, this is something that was definitely done by some people who have sick minds. That was just the way it came across, because people who have love in their hearts are not going to do something as terroristic and as dastardly as was done on that day. But, yes, as you said, I do work in an urban community where some of our students may be suffering or may have homelessness. They're dealing with possibly drugs in and around the community, gangs in the community. And so, you know, a lot of times our students think that they are the only ones that are dealing with these issues. And then when you have a terroristic act like this, they realize that there is a bigger picture, and that there is not only evil in their community, in our communities, but also just evil throughout different parts of the world.
Hmm. Jack Beatty, you can hear each teacher wrestling to reach out to their classrooms, and then there's this debate that maybe gets imposed because teachers, what we're hearing tonight is they deal with it fairly organically, but this notion of whether it's about teaching morality or teaching complexity.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you teach morality, it was wrong, it was evil, it was terrible. End of that. William Bennett, in his teachable moment, I mean, that's a confession, it seems to me, of anti-intellectualism. We need to understand phenomena. Historical phenomena begin in time. They have a sequence. We can make up causalities. One causality may seem more plausible than the next. You know, if causality about Islam doesn't answer issues about U.S. foreign policy, then you have to combine that in the next hypothesis. In short, you have to think. And what Bennett is saying, don't think, call this evil, and let's have a great celebration of how we are, you know, a decent, loving people who've been set upon by these brigands. Well, by these monsters. We have been, but that's not the end of the story. You teach children how to think. And Bennett, alas, in here and in other of his bloviations, doesn't seem very big on thinking so much as on willing. The right, the good, the true, okay, but let's think too.
And yet there is that good, and there is something bad that happened. Pravin is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Welcome, Pravin. You're on the air.
Well, I think that, you know, what happened on September 11th is a very simple story. Men with hate in their hearts who can afford to buy weapons, killing innocents, it's nothing new. It's happened so many times in history, it's an old story. I think that the lesson that we can draw from this entire affair is September 12th and after. Did America respond with dignity? Did the rest of the world rally around and show brotherhood? Even those who had criticized us every chance they had, did they show at that moment that we are a brotherhood of man, and that we all together don't believe that religion ever allows this kind of behavior, no matter what your creed is? And I think our children can learn how a nation conducts itself in the depths of its grief, what anchors it holds on to, how it relates, tries to understand, tries to find a way past it, and still hold all those principles dear that make those who attacked us envy us so badly. If we let them change us, then they win. If we stay the America we are, you know, then we win. And that's the lesson the children have to learn.
Pravin, thank you for your call. Brian Poon, what about it with your seniors in high school? Do you hear them as they search, as they grope for answers and understanding, are they looking for ways to embrace American values and stay as we are, as our caller Pravin puts it? Are they looking to reach out and understand the other, or both?
I think definitely both. I mean, what struck me about the caller was the idea that how do you teach the students? I mean, do I tell my students that something evil has happened, therefore they must organize and be patriotic, or do I listen to them, hear what they need, and then support them as they try to work through it? And as it turns out, the students at Brookline High rallied so strongly, and they came up with their own ideas about how they wanted to help. But if you tell them, if you instruct a student to be moral, then they don't get to claim it. It's not complex. It's not theirs. So once again, I think that the teachable moment is a listening moment. It's not a moment where you make kids do things. I don't think that's good teaching. It's not good practice.
Emma's calling from Boston. Hi, Emma. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, as to the previous caller, and he said that if we keep our values, we win. I was wondering if it's okay to talk about why people from other countries are upset with America and don't like our society, and if you, the teachers, are going to discuss that with your classes tomorrow.
It's a great question. Catherine Lurch, what about in your setting in Indianapolis? Is there anything you can't talk about? Can you discuss the grievances of the attackers?
Absolutely. I'm looking at a copy of one of Thomas Friedman's columns, A Moment of Moral Clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned specifically the question of preserving Western civilization. I've shared this with some of my students, just some excerpts from it. The question was, why evil people hate us for who we are? Many good people dislike us for what we do. And it goes on about how we can deal with this. And my students look upon this as a positive opportunity. One of my students wrote just a little short clip for the newspaper that's coming out this week. The way I see it, why be the pessimist when one looks at all the positive aspects that 9/11 has done for us? Yes, America being attacked by terrorists is a reality now, but we are dealing with it, and we have, for the most part, birthed a stronger sense of who we are, how we view our world, and what we can do to make a difference in it. It's memories themselves that remind us how far we've come since then. Think about it. At what other time in your lives have you seen so many people with American flags on their cars, on their driveways and mailboxes? At what other time did you see churches flooded with people with candles and standing in prayer hand in hand, even when none of them knew each other's names? At what other time were the blood donation banks in Indianapolis so crowded with eager donors that they couldn't fit everyone inside? And at what other time you've gone into a movie theater with a special patriotic tribute to America before all the previews? We've stood together, we've suffered together, and as a result, we've grown together. So, I mean, my students are saying it. I don't need to say it to them. And we're trying to listen to what they're saying. We're looking at a lot of how these actions have affected us in the past as well and bringing them forward in a meaningful way.
Don Renee Chase, I'm sorry, Catherine Lurch, but there's the view from ninth grade Indianapolis. Don Renee Chase in fourth and fifth grade in East Orange, New Jersey. Do you find that you're having to teach patriotism? What do students have a natural bent toward patriotism? Do they even care about patriotism at that age?
Well, yes, we do have to teach them patriotism. We teach them why it is that we do the Pledge of Allegiance, why it is that when something like this happens, it is time for us to try to heal and try to get together. And I'm listening to what one of the students wrote, and I thought that was excellent. This tragedy happened, but what positive thing is going to come out of it? And these are some of the things that our students are able to do. They are able to think of positive things that they can do to help others to get to the healing and to help themselves to get to the healing. But it is something that as younger students we have to implant in them as teachers so that as they become older and they become productive citizens in society, they will have that plant from when they were babes in fourth and fifth grade.
Don Renee Chase, we've got to take a break. We're talking about teaching 9/11. Do we want to educate young patriots or world citizens or both? What do you want our teachers to tell your kids about 9/11? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about teaching 9/11 with three teachers, Don Renee Chase in East Orange, New Jersey, Brian Poon from Brookline, Massachusetts, and Catherine Lurch from Indianapolis. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Alex is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Yes. How are you doing? I just want to say that I've been a longtime caller. Listener, first-time caller. I have a question that's directed towards Brian Poon. For your assignments, how are we going to grade 9/11 assignments in a sensitive manner?
What do you mean by that, Alex? How are you going to grade them? You mean how to assess the content?
Yes. Yeah, so what happens if a student is pro 9/11 and thinks that Osama is right? Is he going to grade the paper on mechanics, structure, or what?
Well, all right. Brian Poon, what if you get a real dissenter among your students' work on 9/11?
Well, actually, none of my assignments tomorrow are graded. I think the complexity of the problem, and I think the emotional complexity makes the idea of signing a letter grade to how someone reacts to such tragedy, it just seems inappropriate. What my kids are doing is that either I've given them articles to read, and they are to read those articles, or they are to find an article, and in many cases, they are to find an article and bring that article into class and share it with one another. The idea being that there's so much information out there that really part of what I'm trying to get my kids to do is process, sift through that, understand it, but their bringing in an article to class is not going to get a letter grade in any way.
And is anything off limits in your class discussion around 9/11?
No, it's not. But in my class, regardless of what we are discussing, respect is paramount. And so I hope there are a panoply of ideas. I hope there is a range. I would be shocked if we all brought in the same article and we all agreed with each other.
Debbie's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Debbie. You're on the air.
Hi. Question I have is it our responsibility to open the students' minds to all sides or perspectives, or should we allow them to debate openly with the potential that this could become a bashing? I mean, do we channel discussion, how we do it differently in a class maybe of high schoolers versus those in middle school or elementary school?
Do you mean it could become a bashing of Arab Americans or Islam and that kind of thing, Debbie?
Most definitely. Yeah, and it's happened. I mean, you definitely see it in the classroom, and the kids are looking for someone to blame.
Are you a teacher, Debbie?
Yes.
And you've seen it?
Yes.
Catherine Lurch, what's your response? Have you seen your classroom turn into a posse?
No, never. At this point, these students, I think you have to lay the ground rules very clearly and say that all views need to be respected. All the students and what they have to bring to the floor is based on perhaps their own personal experience. But we want to have the students look at the evidence, look at the proof that they have found out there, and validate the comments they have. And I think that goes to also what Brian was saying, looking at what his essays that his students may have about not grading. I wouldn't grade them either, but rather I'd look at an example that one of our teachers has done at school this last year as a reaction to this in Afghanistan. We've created a web page where students did editorials based on newspapers from around the world, and these particular topics range anywhere from why do terrorists hate America. That could be an ideal topic even for ninth graders. Mm-hmm. If they can learn the methods at how can they evaluate the evidence, where do they go to different sources and see the different points of view.
So you say dive in.
Dive in, but lay the ground rules so that everyone realizes that what everyone has to say matters and they need to be listened to. And I find that my students are more than eager to do that. They raise their hands. They're patient. They sympathize. They empathize with members of their class who find out that, one of their friends was going to be on one of those flights into the World Trade Center, but she took a different plane. So things like that. The students are very sensitive.
Don Renee Chase, I want to bring you in. There's an 8-year-old in my life who won't be misled about the threat here. You say, well, she says, is there going to be more war? And you say, no. And she says, well, how do you know? And you say, well, maybe it'll be far away. She says, well, it could be right next door. It could be in New York. How do you deal with fear?
Very carefully. What I do is I try to be honest with my students, and I say, we never even thought that this would happen to anywhere in America, two planes going into buildings, but it is a reality that happened. So what it is, no, we don't teach the children to be fearful, but we do teach them, as the other panelists have said, to be respectful of one another. These are things that, of course, obviously have been taught before 9/11 existed, but to be respectful of one another, to look at the differences, but to still know that it's okay for people to be different because everyone has their own unique individual self to be, and to respect that person for who they are, and not to go and to be fearful of everything, but to just be aware of what is going on, not only to be taught in the classroom, but to take it upon yourselves to go to a library and read about things that we may not touch upon in the classroom so that you'll know what is going on, what has happened in the past, and maybe you can make some type of positive contribution so that something like this will not happen in the future.
It's a lot to be aware of. Our time is up, but Dawn Renee Chase, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Dawn Renee Chase teaches at the Cochrane Academy in East Orange, New Jersey. Catherine Lurch, thank you for being with us from Park Tudor School in Indianapolis.
Thank you very much for the opportunity as well.
And Brian Poon, history and philosophy teacher at Brookline High School, Brookline, Massachusetts. Thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you very much.
In a moment, a journalism professor describes the delicate art of eulogizing. This is On Point. After September 11th, veteran reporter and Columbia journalism professor Ann Nelson wrote her first play, The Guys. Within months, crowds of New Yorkers had packed the off-Broadway Flea Theater to witness what has been lauded as one of the most cathartic pieces of writing about that terrible day and its aftermath. Based on Nelson's own experience after September 11th, The Guys is a story about two New Yorkers. Nick, a fire captain, finds himself in need of a writer, someone to help him compose eulogies for eight of his men who died in the World Trade Center collapse. Joan, a writer, volunteers to help him write the eulogies, just as Nelson did for a real-life New York fire chief last September. In this radio diary, Ann Nelson shares the story of how she came to meet and help the real-life fire chief whose passion and grief inspired her play.
In the week after September 11th, I was like a lot of people in New York City, feeling the shock of the attack and really not knowing what my role could be. It didn't seem as though anything that I had to offer was applicable. And yet, really everyone that I knew wanted to do something. I went to visit my sister who lives in Park Slope with my family, and we were just spending the day together, and the phone did ring, and her friend said that there was a fire captain who was very anxious. He knew he had to give some eulogies very soon for the men he'd lost, and he really didn't feel that he could do it on his own. He was looking for a writer, and so I just said, I'll return the call. When I got the call about doing the eulogies, the first thing I thought was, eulogy, noble rhetoric. And I went to the bookstore and borrowed a bunch of books of poetry and great orators and brought them back and stacked them on the table. I never opened them. The minute that this fellow came into the room and started talking about his friends, I said, this language is powerful. My job is to get out of the way. My job as a writer is to listen. And there is so much beautiful emotion in the way he expressed his concern for his men and their families. There's so much caring. And then there's the Irish humor. And then there's the firehouse slang. And it was very humbling to me as a writer. The theoretical element, the $5 words you learn at the Ivy League, seemed very impotent compared to these ways of expressing yourself. So I said, okay, the eulogies should capture his voice. I've been interested to read in the newspapers that the political figures of New York felt nothing could be written or said in terms of speeches that would capture the magnitude of September 11th. I think that's a pity. For example, when I've had friends who've died and I talk to the widow or the survivors or the children, I think the first impulse is just embarrassment. I don't know what to say. I might say the wrong thing. Maybe I won't say anything. But if you talk to them, sometimes it's all right just to say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry this happened. I'm with you. And the challenge as a writer is in moments like these to find ways of saying it that are authentic and that are not cliched, because every loss is true. It's a true loss. It's not fair to turn it into a cliche. But my philosophy in writing and in life is that it's usually better to do something, even if you fear it's inadequate, than to hang back and do nothing at all. In taking this jewel of someone's spirit and offering it to people through a play, I think I was hoping to offer the feeling of hope that meeting him gave me, and the way that that addressed my own sense of despair. Something in me woke up and said, well, if someone like this is around, it can't be all bleak.
Ann Nelson is Director of International Programs for the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. A movie adaptation of her play, The Guys, premieres tomorrow at the Toronto Film Festival. Jack, are you still there in New York?
I'm here.
And you're ready tonight to see, to be part of, along with the whole country, along with the world, the anniversary observances tomorrow. You've looked over the menu of what's going on. What are you expecting? What are you anticipating, Jack?
Well, starting at 1 o'clock in the morning, from all the five boroughs of the city, the marching bands from the fire department, the city department, the sanitation department, they're all going to start marching. And at 8 a.m., they're going to converge at Ground Zero, having marched from the boroughs. And then there are going to be four different moments of citywide moments of silence, for the 2 moments when the 2 planes hit, and then for the 2 moments when the 2 towers fell. And interspersed between there, New York Governor Pataki is going to read the Gettysburg Address. Former Mayor Rudy Giuliani is going to start reciting the victims' names. Taps will be played. And Governor James McGreevy of New Jersey is going to read from the Declaration of Independence. And then later in the day, President Bush will visit Ground Zero, and then he himself will speak from the Statue of Liberty Park. And tomorrow night, Mayor Bloomberg will recite Franklin Roosevelt's 4 Freedoms at a ceremony at Battery Park.
Bush's speech, the only original for the day speech of those. I mean, great speeches, Gettysburg, Declaration of Independence, but not fresh for 9/11.
No, and you know, there's some hint that the survivors did not want to hear the politicians talk, but it's also clear that the politicians have sort of lived down to our low estimate of them. I mean, we don't expect anything from politicians these days, but what a difference from the past. Reagan on the Challenger, Clinton on Oklahoma City, FDR, his Day of Infamy speech. I've seen the manuscript. Day of Infamy is in his handwriting. He put it into Robert Sherwood's draft, and further down, he scratches out an adjective, and he puts in an adjective. An adjective that Dawn Chase just used, dastardly. He refers to it as dastardly. Mm-hmm. Well, look at that. She's still using that word to frame villainy of an almost Shakespearean kind. Now, that's what great rhetoric does. It lasts the years, as the Gettysburg Address does, and nothing anyone's going to say tomorrow, unfortunately, is going to live on like that, or at least if they're just going to be repeating what other people have said. Maybe the president will rise to it.
Maybe not, but, you know, Jack, I can, even as the country's been kind of shuddering toward this day, this anniversary, with a lot of apprehension and the security warnings today, I also feel maybe the people are ahead of politicians on this. Maybe there's a readiness to break through to new insights about the meaning of that day, which will be a year ago tomorrow.
Well, maybe it'll begin tomorrow with something someone will say.
Jack, we'll talk to you in New York City tomorrow. Thanks for being there tonight.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBU.